day. That's the book of nature. So I know most of you like the special revelation. You prefer the Bible studies, but we're going to do a little science today, so bear with me. And I did part one about 6 months ago. Some of you were here. That's the same handout. I might have updated it slightly. Vocabulary on one side, you should have it. If not, share with somebody near you. And on the other side is a table we'll go over in a few minutes. So I think I want to go right to the last slide, last few slides, to show you some recent discoveries just that you've probably heard in the news. And we'll start with this one. And let me know if you've heard about this. TRAPPIST-1 system. So we're talking about exoplanets. Now, you should have looked at some of your vocabulary terms, and you'll see what exoplanet is, in case you get a little lost there. And the TRAPPIST-1 was just recently discovered. It's a small red star, class M. And it has seven planets. What made it so interesting was that the planets are close to the size of Earth. Of the thousands of planets that they found so far out orbiting stars, most of them are giants. The planets are more like Jupiter. But this one has seven. And so you've heard a lot in the news about it, how they could... You notice there's this zone around the star itself. The star's the little orange thing in the middle. And then you got the seven planets, which they've drawn oversized, of course. In the green area on there, that's what we call the habitable zone. And it's habitable in only one reference, and that is liquid water may exist on its surface. It might. And so... Yeah, and then a lot of these astrobiologists or astroscientists go on to say, well, that means life could be there. So, you know, I say that a little facetiously, but they just presume that, and that's the area where, you know, it's just warm enough where it won't be ice, and it's not so warm that it won't evaporate away. And so... That green zone is what we call, what they call the water habitable zone or habitable zone. And so that's what they're trying to say, is that this star just 40 light years away, which is relatively close, has three planets that may harbor life. Do they have any evidence of it? No.
No.
None. The ones in the green zone, which would be E, F, and G. So that's TRAPPIST-1E, TRAPPIST-1F, and TRAPPIST-1G. That's how they name them. They usually don't give any planets an A. So they start with B. Another discovery, this one I don't have a drawing, an artist drawing, but this is Proxima B, and that's been in the news a lot lately. And if you look at the top drawing here, there's two drawings on here. Look at the upper part. And I can use this little pointer. Look at this part up here. This shows relatively... Here's our sun. And right next to it, you see Proxima Centauri, one of the three stars there. And our sun, this is how far out Mercury's orbit would be. Well, on this little red star, that's how far out the planets are. That's the green zone you saw on that other slide, is kind of like that. But Proxima B is in the green zone also, that planet, and maybe it'll harbor life. It might have liquid water. No way to know. We cannot tell. We do not have instruments that can look at these planets. Despite all the drawings you may see in the news, they show continents and water and stuff. We can't. We don't know that. Let's see. Now, here's one a little more exciting, I think. This is in our own solar system, of course. It's not an exoplanet. Exoplanet would imply it's not with our sun. But this is just one of the moons around Saturn. Enceladus, or Enceladus, how you want to pronounce it. Yeah, it makes you hungry. I don't know. You know, I don't know why he got that name. To tell you the truth, it's a moon on Saturn. The exciting thing is, this is typical. You notice that it's covered with ice, and it's miles deep of ice. And this is, you often heard about how many planets that are formed are loaded with water. Even the Earth had miles of water over it at one time, the very beginning. And so when you get past a certain area, out of the green zone, past it, or the habitable zone, then of course the water freezes. And on this planet, there's a satellite we have orbiting around it called Cassini, and it found plumes of steam or something coming up from the surface. And so they got the satellite to go closer and orbit nearer where these vents were. And they found that it is indeed water vapor coming up from below the ice, being shot up. And in it, they found hydrogen. You know, the element hydrogen. And hydrogen is a highly energetic molecule. And so the thinking is maybe there's organisms down, way down underneath the ice, like in the hydrothermal vents on Earth, you know, under the ocean. You've seen those clams and things that grow around those hydrothermal vents. Well, they think there might be some here, too. There's no way to know, though. But indeed, at least we were able to make samples, to get samples of what's underneath the ice, because it's spewed up like a volcano at certain spots around this moon. So that's been in the news quite a bit. Let's see what else we got. LHS 1140b. This is another small planet, a small star, red dwarf, class M. And it's got a planet orbiting it that is about Earth size. And it's also in the habitable zone. That is, it might have liquid water on it. So those are four newsworthy things that we've heard a lot about lately. Let me go back to the beginning now. Not used to using this program here, so bear with me for a second. It's probably a real fast way to do this.
While you're searching, Mark,
yeah.
You know, once again,
go ahead.
It's got to be really very strong, because Hugh said the same thing. These small red stars, when they talk about habitable zones, they're averaging the habitable zones. Because the red stars are so unstable, that green circle is constantly moving.
Good point.
That a lot of these scientists don't talk about how unstable these stars are and how the zone is going.
Right.
For comparison, our sun varies by 0.1% in variance, say, over a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years.
Yeah.
These typical red dwarf stars typically vary up to 40%, 30-40% of their luminance, which means that green zone collapses down where none of the planets are within it.
Right.
And the green zone could expand if it
can.
Has first, and now beyond that, it's all fried.
Exactly.
And because of this, because the star is so dim, as you said, the planets are so close that you have to say they're all tidally locked, which means one side
very likely tidally locked.
Star very warm.
Yeah.
This side that's away from the star is always going to be very cold.
True. Dave is right. That green zone we saw, what I call the habitable zone, especially on these little red stars, these class M stars. Our sun is called a class G. It's a yellow star. It's a pretty stable, larger star. But these little class M stars are red, and about 80% of the stars in the heavens are class M. Very few, only about 7% are class G like our sun. And so, I'll be in with you in a second, Mara. And so the class M's are very unstable. And they emit huge amounts of radiation at times, and then other times they cool down. So that green habitable zone that the planets might be in is shrinking and enlarging and moving back and forth. How's that going to be helpful for life? Not very. Yeah, Mara.
When you have shown
Enceladus?
Yeah, you said this planet. So I didn't know if that moon can also be considered a planet in one of these exoplanet things. Is a moon considered one of those also?
Good question.
Yeah,
if I used it together, that was a mistake. The moons are usually considered a different thing, or they orbit planets. So,
right.
Yeah,
so
and then planets orbit stars.
That's what I thought, but then
no, you're right. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, no, but what's happening on that moon could happen on a planet. Probably not in our solar system. It could be happening on Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus or Neptune, but they're so covered with gases we can't see anything there. And anything being volcanically emitted on those planets, we wouldn't see it hardly. Yeah, Dave.
If you could just mention why you have that, is that what's happening is the tidal friction of the planet, Jupiter, is so strong that it turns mm-hmm.
That's the energy source for those volcanic plumes coming out of that moon. Yeah, good point. I wasn't going to cover that, but there has to be a source of energy, right? And those small moons generally have very little radioactive material in their core. So instead, they get the energy from the tidal friction, tidal distortion that the larger planet puts on them, like Jupiter, very strong gravity. So it's distorting that small moon Enceladus as it goes around. Jupiter has one like that too. It's also emitting plumes. So. Okay, let's see. Yes, Dave.
With regard to what Bart was saying, it's my understanding, and I think Hugh's the one where I got this from, is that the moon actually was created from a planet hitting the Earth, right?
Yes. Well, that's the collider event, it's called.
Yeah.
It happened in the very early history of Earth, and I'm not really going to get into that today because it would take too much time. But let's just move on here. Let's see, today's topic for exoplanets, current state about the... Let me move along here. I don't want to take too long. Habitability, the properties that a planet must have, it is to be able to host life. And these drawings you see here, astrobiology is a study of life in the galaxy. Those are purely an artist's rendition, an imagination, okay? We have no clue about what they might look like. Yeah, that second one looks like there's life there, but some kind of mushrooms or something. Okay, just a quick outline of our presentation. Five things that we'll be covering if we have time. If you know not, I'll go as far as I can today. I'll let you read a few things. I guess I should read everything for Steve. I'll read most of this stuff. Why should exoplanets and extraterrestrial life and intelligent be of interest to the Christian apologist? Okay, the science of exoplanets has exploded in recent decades because of increasing sophisticated detection technology. We have much better telescopes and satellites and so on. Huge increase in knowledge. You hear that about everything. Assumption of reductive materialism dominates these efforts. All of the institutions that are involved view the results as forward progress that overtakes theism. So reductive materialism, anybody... Mark, what is that?
It's the belief that you can reduce everything that exists, the explanations for everything, to some material cause. So that's reduction.
Everything's material. Yeah. There's no need for God. Everything is just, it's here. You know, it's the universe that we live in. Okay, accepted narrative that accompanies the search for exoplanets and ET life. Since the time of Galileo and Copernicus, science has continually diminished the status of humans in the universe. And the Copernican revolution removed humans from their central location. Correct. Biological evolution by means of natural selection, that Darwinism, showed that humans are just another species on Earth and are not the center of the biological universe. Well, that's an implication. The discovery of life and intelligence on other planets will complete the demotion of humans. Earth and humans are not special in any way. So that's the belief. Yes, Mara. Yeah, that's called panspermia.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And Richard Dawkins believes in it.
Oh, he does.
So they think that they like to reduce us, but they like to think there was some other God.
Yes. And what does that do? That just, all that does is remove the problem from here and puts it somewhere else. So you don't solve anything with that. Yeah. Oh, very good. Okay.
I might point out Kim. That last comment there.
Yeah.
A lot of the people who are involved in this and people who read about that are not seeing that this demotes human, making them completely unspecial. Finding advanced life in other civilization kind of elevates us to a level to where we can communicate beyond just the species kind of level thing. We're smart enough to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it really makes us special in that sense.
Yeah.
Not special in terms of uniqueness, but special in terms of our ability to do these things.
Right. I didn't mean to imply everybody's that way. You know, a lot of scientists are actually Christians. And so, okay, here's some of the, just a few of the planets and that they've discovered. The one right in the middle, Kepler 552, is probably the most interesting. And we'll get to that in a moment. But look at the drawings. Look at the artist's work here. Same problem. You cannot see exoplanets that well. All you usually see of an exoplanet is a darkening of its star as it goes, as it orbits past its star. You know, there's a little shadow. So the amount of light coming from the star decreases. That's one way we see it. It's called transit. So we can't see this kind of detail. These are just drawings. And so will we ever be able to? Probably not in any of our lifetimes. You'd have to make some telescopes that are like, probably twice as big as the one on, what's that one in Hawaii on Mauna Loa? The Keck. And so that's something. You'd have to make one probably about 15 meters in diameter. And that means you have to get it into outer space and it has to function before you could start seeing anything close to this. Right now, what do we have? What's the telescope that we have up there?
Hubble.
Anybody know what the size of the diameter of the lens is on it? It's about 2.5 meters.
What's a meter?
A meter's about a yard, so 3 feet. So it'd be that. Hubble's maybe a little further than I can reach, and you need something that's probably 100 times bigger before you're going to start to see some of this stuff. We're nowhere near. We don't have any rockets that can launch things like that. Maybe in 50 years.
Yeah, even then, you're pointing at a very bright object.
Yeah.
You're still not going to get very good.
No. Images. Well, the way they'll do it, Dave, is they put this chronograph up. You got to have one satellite that's a chronograph, and it blocks the light from the sun, from the star. And then when the star gets over to the side, then you can get a look at it. But you got to have a powerful telescope, a chronograph telescope, and then wait till it gets to the side, and then you might get a good look at it with a giant telescope. Well, that's down the road. And I have a video to watch. In search of Earth 2.0.
In search of Earth 2.0, presented by Science at NASA. NASA's Kepler spacecraft is a prolific hunter of planets outside of our solar system. Since it launched in 2009, Kepler has confirmed more than 1,000 of these exoplanets and cataloged thousands of more candidates. The menagerie includes planets with densities greater than iron and lower than styrofoam, planets smaller than Mercury and bigger than Jupiter, planets with one sun, two suns, and even four suns. The number and variety of exoplanets is exhilarating to researchers, but in some ways the collection leaves something to be desired. Laypeople and scientists alike share a longing to find one particular type of world, a world like Earth, that speaks to us in a way that hot Jupiters and multiple star systems cannot. We long for a world whose very existence cries, "We are not alone." Kepler has just found the closest analog to the Earth-Sun system. In July 2015, NASA announced the discovery of Kepler-452b, an exoplanet a little over 1.5 times wider than Earth, orbiting a G2-type star similar to our own Sun. Moreover, Kepler-452b's orbit is located in the Goldilocks zone of its star system, where the temperature is just right for liquid water to exist.
All right, let me run it back.
This is also known as the habitable zone, because water is required for life as
Okay.
In Search of Earth 2.0, presented by Science at NASA.
Sorry, Dave,
NASA's
I was
Kepler
playing with volume, too.
NASA's Kepler spacecraft is a prolific hunter of planets outside of our solar system. Since it launched in 2009, Kepler has confirmed more than 1,000 of these exoplanets and cataloged thousands of more candidates. The menagerie includes planets with densities greater than iron and lower than styrofoam, planets smaller than Mercury and bigger than Jupiter, planets with one sun, two suns, and even four suns.
That's my power, dude.
The number and variety of exoplanets is exhilarating to researchers, but in some ways the collection leaves something to be desired. Laypeople and scientists alike share a longing to find one particular type of world, a world like Earth, that speaks to us in a way that hot Jupiters and multiple star systems cannot. We long for a world whose very existence cries, "We are not alone." Kepler has just found the closest analog to the Earth-Sun system. In July 2015, NASA announced the discovery of Kepler-452b, an exoplanet a little over 1.5 times wider than Earth, orbiting a G2-type star similar to our own Sun. Moreover, Kepler-452b's orbit is located in the Goldilocks zone of its star system, where the temperature is just right for liquid water to exist. This is also known as the habitable zone, because water is required for life as we know it. We can think of Kepler-452b as an older, bigger cousin to Earth, says John Jenkins of NASA's Ames Research Center, who led the team that discovered Kepler-452b. It's awe-inspiring to consider that this planet has spent 6 billion years in the habitable zone of its star, longer than Earth. That's substantial opportunity for life to arise should all the necessary ingredients and conditions for life exist on this planet. Kepler-452b isn't the first exoplanet found in a habitable zone. Indeed, about a dozen such worlds in this size range have been discovered so far. That is, 10 to 15 planets between one-half and twice the diameter of Earth, depending on how the habitable zone is defined and allowing for uncertainties in measured planetary sizes. Among those dozen, Kepler-452b fires the imagination most because it is the closest analog to the Earth-Sun system discovered to date, a planet only a little over 1.5 times the diameter of Earth, orbiting within the habitable zone of a star very much like our own Sun. A year on Kepler-452b is 385 days long, only a few weeks longer than a year on Earth. The planet is only 5% farther from its parent star than Earth is from the Sun. This extra distance is mitigated by extra sunlight. Kepler-452b's parent star is 20% brighter and has a diameter 10% larger than the Sun. The similarities are remarkable indeed, says John Grunsfeld, Associate Administrator of NASA's Science Mission Directorate at the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This exciting result brings us one step closer to finding an Earth 2.0. Kepler-452b whispers the possibility that we are not alone. How much longer before a new discovery shouts it out? In Search of Earth 2.0.
Well, what do you think?
Presented by Science at NASA.
Sounds good, huh? Well,
too good to be true.
I think so, Steve. There seems like minor differences, huh? Its sun's 20% brighter. It's 10% bigger. It's the planet's a little further out. The sun that star is 6.5 billion years old. So it's a lot older than our sun. Our sun's only 4.5 billion. And what we've learned in here is that our sun is at its most stable period right now. In a few million more years, just million, I remember this, we're talking billions for the age of those stars, our sun is going to become very violent and emit a lot of radiation, that a lot more than it is now. And life on Earth won't be possible.
Is that sun like that now?
It probably is. We can't tell. We don't know. The best we can do now is just know that these planets are there around these other stars, and we cannot really tell what kind of gases are in their atmosphere, let alone see what they look like. And so that's just how it is. Yes?
My question is that you made these sun systems with perfectly orbital. I mean, aren't they kind of in and out? And in other words,
good point.
It's not typical to have them just go straight.
Right. One other thing about our solar system is the planets are in really nice circular orbits. Not perfect, but very nice. Well, almost all the other systems, and you're going to see something in a few minutes, are very elliptical. You know, instead of a nice round orbit, it's got this orbit kind of like this. It stretches way out on one side. And so that is harmful to life, you know, because the sun, like Dave said earlier, the habitable zone is going to, that planet's going to go in and out of that green habitable zone. Helen?
Does Kepler 452b have a moon, and what's the rotation and the length of a day?
Okay. We don't know if it has a moon. We can't tell. It's close. We don't know its rotation rate. Is it 24 hours? Is it a year to make one day? You know, we don't know. So, Mara?
I don't know if this is just the illustration, but it looks like, you know, Hugh always talks about the beautiful blue dot of the Earth. They made that look like it had water and planets. Yeah. I don't know if it was just an illustration, very much like the Earth. They made it look like it.
Yeah.
And they're real quick.
Yeah, they're very quick to do that, and they're very quick to show continents and oceans on almost every drawing.
But that's
not
I'm asking, is that true?
No. Is it? Not, that's not the correct answer. The correct answer is we cannot tell.
So they just kind of made that
into it's part of the hype. There's a lot of hype going on. Unfortunately, as much as we all love NASA, it does do a lot of hype, you know, and spinning of stories. Yeah, John.
A proton flux from the star that would fry any of the most hardiest form of life in about 1 second.
Okay.
It was an Earth-like planet.
But it was Earth-like. Yeah, Dave.
Just so we know the terminology, we are being a little bit honest in this. The word they used was analog.
They did use analog. Yeah.
The difference, obviously, is when they find something that's like the Earth, they will use twin. So the search is for a solar twin. So they're looking for the sun. They realize to have life, stars have been cataloged in the databases of knowledge, and out of those 3 million, we have not found a solar twin. We have not found one star out of these 3 billion stars that's like our sun. And so when we find a star that's similar to our sun, they call that an analog. And the same here, we're looking for a twin of Earth, and we have not found a twin. So when you use the word twin, that's when you have to perk your ears and say, are they being honest? Have they found
it? Right.
An analog just means it's something that's similar.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, they're honest. The dishonest part, obviously, is at 1.5 times gravity, that means that this is going to have, the stars, you know, this planet is going to have a very thick atmosphere, and it would look more like Venus than it would Earth, because a star that's that big, you couldn't have human life on there, even at Optimum Commission. As you've already talked about, that the fine tuning of a planet has to be the gravitational pull that we have. You know, that if you have less gravity, you can't walk. You know, so when you saw the astronauts went to the moon, they had difficulty walking there. If the astronauts go to Mars, they would have the same difficulty. If you can't walk on Mars, there's not enough gravity. And on the flip side, if you have 1.5 times the gravity, that's going to be so much, you know, that you would have difficulty crawling on that planet,
right,
let alone walking, right? You know, so you know, if you don't believe me, you know, just, you know, go and take your weight, whatever you are. If you're 100 pounds, put a 50-pound weight on your back and try and do everything, you know, you can.
Our bodies can take about 1.5 Gs, and then after that, we can't walk.
Yeah, the problem with the next part of that is then is the breathing.
Yeah.
The atmosphere pressure would be so great your lungs wouldn't function.
More questions. Yes, Jocelyn. Twin sun, remember earlier I talked about our sun being what's called a G star? There's several alphabetically named the main sequence of stars. And right in the middle of the group of about seven levels of stars is the G. And that would in our yellow star. And so that's the first thing you have to, it has to be a G level star. Like our sun. And then it's about the size of our sun. It usually has yellow-white light, and it can have planets anywhere in its orbit. They could be close, they could be far, but it has just the right amount of light and stability to make life possible on Earth. If our sun was a hotter star, or a cooler star like these M-class red stars, life wouldn't be possible here. So G is the most conducive to life, and at least the kind of life we know of. And, you know, with carbon-based life, with chlorophyll and that can change light into carbohydrates and so on, with carbon dioxide. So the G is the perfect star as far as we can tell. And then Gs vary a lot. They have different categories of Gs. That Kepler 452, that was a little bigger than our G star and older and so on. So it's not as stable and good as ours. Yes, Steve.
You know, I was just wondering, I'm not trying to be funny, but I sort of am, but I'm wondering from that last NASA spin how the Mormons would respond. If I were a Mormon, I would want to be populated.
No, that's a good question. The Mormons, in fact, the Mormons very much are into the exoplanet thing. And you guys are specialists on them. And they very much want to find intelligent ET, you know, extraterrestrial life out there. I guess it somehow fits their theology. What is it? Because for instance, a male would inhabit or would inherit a planet someday, right, if you're saved through Mormonism. So it fits. It fits their religion. Good question. Yeah. Valerie.
Okay, well, I know a lot of people watch Star Trek, but if you notice how many Star Trek planets are M-class suns.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It confused me when I was watching all those.
The way it goes, let's see, trying to remember now. I can't remember the exact. Where's Tim? Does he know?
G-K-M.
M is the little red stars, the final ones, the smallest ones in the main series, okay? The main sequence. And that's what 80% of the stars out there are M-class, little red, tiny stars. And all this news we're getting is almost always about planets orbiting little red stars. And yet they're trying to tell us that Well, even the M-class stars have a habitable zone. There's got to be some planets in that little water zone. Let me get into that right here. This is from the first presentation I did. So I just wanted to review a couple slides here for you. And this shows you habitable zone. You can see, where are we? We're the bottom green layer. That's us, our solar system. See the very bottom? And you see our planets drawn on there. And you see which planets are in the habitable zone. That's the water habitable zone. Earth, Venus, maybe. It's right on the inside. Mars, slightly on the outside. So the Earth's somewhere near the middle. And then you go to Kepler 452, that other yellow star that we saw in here. And it's one planet that they found, 452b. And you can see that it's also in the so-called habitable zone. Then you go to a typical red star right on top here. See that? That little orbital system right up here. That's Kepler 186. And you see those? That's a little M-class red dwarf. And you can see how small its orbit is. And that's generally how the planets are. They're stuck right on in there.
Are those red stars older stars?
Red stars don't hardly ever, they don't nova. They can last a trillion years. So they're not necessarily older than our sun, but they just don't, you know, our sun will eventually nova, but the red stars don't. Let's see here. Let me go on to okay, here's another way of looking at it. Instead of green, this one's drawn with a blue swath through it. It's graphically presented. And at the very top, you see our yellow sun. See on the top y-axis? That's a G star, our sun. And look over to the right, x-axis. You'll see all our planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And which ones are in the blue or habitable zone? You see Mars, Earth, they drew Venus outside of it. And of course, the gas giants are all outside of it. It's too cold out there. And then go down to the very bottom, near the bottom of the y-axis, you see a dwarf red star, class M. And yeah, it has a habitable zone also, but it's very close to the star.
Yeah, and Mark, once again, obviously on this one, you have to picture this because it's still, it should be a moving image, is you would have to say the top is fixed and the bottom would wave back and forth like a flag.
Yeah, look at that swath. What Dave is saying is that it's going to be moving like this and this as the star's temperature and radiation change. It might even widen and shrink. Yeah. It depends on how stable the star is. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, someday that someone may come up with some good videos on that.
But they might lie.
They might. Okay. This is your handout. Let's look at this. We're going to do them one at a time here, so let me put it on. Is there really only one habitable zone? Water. No. What has Hugh Ross shown in his book, Improbable Planet? 8 or 9 other zones that these astrobiologists and astronomers don't even take into account. They ignore all this other stuff. So we saw the green zone, the habitable zone, right? But imagine a bunch of other zones, and they all have to overlap perfectly. So the first one, let's see, what's the first one on here? Water habitable, well, we know about that. Ultraviolet habitable zone. Planets receiving just right UV levels for life. Life actually needs some UV, some ultraviolet light. It's helpful. That coming on, yeah. Photosynthetic habitable zone, you have to be at the just right area so that chlorophyll will work. There are other compounds that will absorb light and change it into energy and carbohydrates, but they're very low efficient.
And also there's life forms that exist like at the bottom of the ocean near volcanoes and stuff where there's no sunlight, right?
Right. Those are not, they don't use photosynthesis. There's no chlorophyll. They're just using energy out of other chemicals, which is what we do. you know, animals, herbivores and carnivores, we don't have chlorophyll, right? We animals, I'm talking about the whole animal world. And so there's the ozone habitable zone, and planets with ozone layers to protect life from the stellar wind radiation. The sun is constantly putting out a lot of radiation. So here, that's another important zone. And another is planetary rotation rate zone. Planets require just right atmosphere mixing. The Earth goes too fast or too slow, it causes, you know, hurricanes or deserts. So it's got to be rotating at the just right speed. Planetary obliquity habitable zone. It's tilt. One second, Ross. Is very important. And the tilt because the Earth is tilted, we have seasons and we have higher agricultural yields. So that's important. Tidal habitable zone. 90% of the stars are less than half the sun's mass. So their planets must orbit so close that they become tidally locked. You know how the moon is tidally locked? We only see pieces of one side, right? Either the whole thing or one half or one. That's being tidally locked. It does not spin around. It doesn't have days anymore. And so that's obviously going to be extremely harmful to life. Astrosphere. Habitable zone, the stellar winds, particles, magnetic radiation intensity must be just right. If you get too much, it'll even go past our magnetic fields on the Earth and kill everything. And a new discovery, the electric field habitable zone, or space weathering zone, I think is the same thing. Planets must locate where the star's ultraviolet won't dissociate too much water, H2O, into hydrogen and oxygen, which are then lost into the outer atmosphere. That's what happened on Venus. So here you got 9 more or 8 more zones to deal with. They all have to overlap. You'll never see anything in any media broadcast about these zones. They're just as important as the water habitable zone. Yeah, Ross.
Mark, I think Hugh's come up with how many parameters that need to be just right for life to exist. It's in the hundreds.
Yeah, thousands. Yeah. No. In a way, they definitely could be just as important as these 9 habitable zones.
But each one has a range in which life can exist.
But they aren't necessarily dealing with a star. See, these are the ones that deal with a star, okay?
Physical location.
Yeah.
So the fact that we have lots of radiation in the middle of our planet, that's not a zone. That's a feature.
Well, right. It's not, and it's not dependent upon the sun.
Right.
No, Ross is right. There are. It's very, very important point. There's 1,000 or more other issues needed to make the Earth just right for life. I'm just talking about how the ones that the sun affects, or that the stars affect. So, yeah, and then when you add them all together, you get these tremendous odds of life not being possible anywhere. And I think you've all seen that. Okay. Yes, Tim.
The last sentence down there.
Yeah.
Say that too much water is associated to hydrogen and oxygen, resulting in oxygen loss. Wouldn't it be the hydrogen loss to space?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Hydrogen would be lost too. But hydrogen isn't so critical for life as oxygen is.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Right.
And, you know, you're probably going to have other things dissociated and lost, too, you know. If it's strong enough, you even get nitrogen atoms breaking, you know, and they might be lost. Okay, so let me go back to slide presentation 2. Everything moved around on here now. Okay, so we saw that, right? Let's just go through these. Put it back on presentation. Okay, we've talked about that, Kepler-452. the artist's rendition. See, continents, clouds, water vapor cloud, oceans, just like Earth. Yeah. Okay, and Kepler 452 is 5 times more massive than Earth. Orbital period is 384 days. Most likely it has a dense H2, that's hydrogen atmosphere, with a runaway greenhouse effect, like sort of like, well, Venus doesn't have hydrogen, I don't think, but it's got a runaway greenhouse effect. Okay, and then these are the ways, how can we tell that there's a planet orbiting a star somewhere? There's probably a dozen ways to measure. Here's 5 of them, and I'll talk about, and then we'll watch a little video in a second, but radio velocity, the first one says watching for wobble. That's radio velocity. You're actually looking at the Doppler effect of light changing frequencies. And you'll see that in a minute. Searching for shadows, that's a transit. That's what the Kepler satellite does. It sees a little shadow go over a star. Yeah. And so it's difficult, though. If it's not lined up perfectly with us, the star, the planet, if the planet's up here, we won't see it ever. It's light years away. And then taking pictures directly, you know, with a telescope, gravity lens, you probably know about Einstein's gravity, you know, general relativity, very large body will have a strong gravity and it'll actually bend light. And when if we're in just the right position, it'll bend the light of something and focus it right on us, and we'll get this enlargement. But it's only like less than 1% of the planets we've found. And minuscule movements, astrometry or astrometry, you'll see that in a second. And so, you know, I'm going to try to open this using our
Wi-Fi.
Yeah, let's see if the Wi-Fi works. I have it saved on here too, hard copy. That didn't seem to go too well. Oh, wait, there it goes. We'll have a test here. Has anybody ever used the Wi-Fi in here? Okay. No, I don't mean your phone. I mean for Yeah. Okay. This one has no audio. Sorry, Dave. I'm not seeing the video either. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. It's loading. Okay. Yeah.
It's having a little bit of a pinch.
So I'll try to describe it, Steve, as we go along here. 5 exoplanet detection methods, and they're in a different order on this than they were on that previous slide. Astrometry, is that the right way to say that, Tim?
Astrometry
method, observe the star's motion. And you can see that as a planet orbits a star, the planet's gravity actually causes the star to move a little bit. So less than 1% of the planets we found were done this way. So it's not real common. Yes?
Maybe you could do this and next time you teach. I would like to understand Einstein's law of relativity.
Both?
I can't get it.
Okay. Yeah.
In your spare time.
There. Yes.
Genius.
Well, we got an expert here. His name's Hugh Ross. Yeah. There may be a layman's level description. Someday. Okay. All right, now, here's the the gravitational microlensing. Here's Earth, that little blue thing at the bottom. I'll run it back by there a second. Remember I told you this is Einstein's theory that large the gravity can bend. Oh, did we miss one?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, let me go back here, sorry. All right, we finished this one, astrometry. And the second one was... Okay, let's do astrometry again. Okay, here's direct imaging. That's like you with your telescope, except you'll never see an exoplanet. Okay, now, this is a star, and notice it's like a chronograph. It blocked the star out, and then you can see the planet for a second. That's the best you're going to get.
It's a shadow.
It's not quite a shadow. It's actually the planet. But the light from the star isn't messing you up. You've got clear vision. And now here's microlensing, like Einstein predicted. Here's a real heavy object. It's light coming out, and you can see how it bends space-time. Here's a planet coming by with its star, and there's Earth, that little blue thing at the bottom. And it focused right on the Earth. So that's only one out of a million that it would ever happen. But it's very interesting. Okay, radial velocity. This is the Doppler effect. And this is the second most common. Now, it'll make it clearer in a second here. Here's a planet orbiting its star. We're changing position. Now watch as the star moves backwards. Now it's going to move forward. It's going to light waves are going to compress. You're going to get a higher frequency. Then as it moves back, light waves are going to stretch out because light cannot change its speed. It always goes the speed of light. So to make up for it, it changes its frequency. And sound does the same thing. That's called the Doppler effect. But you can exceed sound, the speed of sound. You can't do it with light.
I never knew
stars rotated like that. They can. Planet transit. Now, this is now the common way with Kepler space satellite. Now, watch the little graph on the left, lower left. As it goes in front of the star, its light goes down. And then back up. That's the evidence you got an exoplanet. That's it. If you're on a plane, you can make it last longer, maybe. Okay, so let me get that one out of there. So those are the methods, and they are genuine. They're scientific methods for measuring. You know, they're kind of indirect, but they're real. Okay, where am I now? Got to get myself back in. Okay, just this slide here. We're on 13. How much time? Okay, we're not going to get done, but we'll finish half of it. Generalized conclusion so far. What you're seeing there is a planet forming. Protoplanetary disk on that little picture. Planets are formed, they think, in one of two ways, you know, dust coming together. I'm not going to get into the details, but there's a couple ways at least. More than 80% of stars are thought to have planets. That's true. Each star is thought to have an average of 1 to 2 planets in its habitable zone. Recent exoplanet discoveries have forced major changes in the theories of planet formation. Perhaps 20 to 30 planets are initially formed around a star. Giant Jupiter-like planets have a tendency to migrate towards the star. Unlike our Jupiter, it actually migrated outward. And Saturn even more so. But almost every other one we've found, the gas giants migrated in. And it disrupted all the orbits of any planets that were forming. So you won't find a nice, clean solar system like ours. They're just real rare, so far anyway. Here's another way to look at it. There's a proto-sun forming in the middle. And then as you go to the left on your screen, you see what's called a frost line here. right there, that line. That's the frost line. And planets that are forming on the inside here tend to be rocky. They call it metal and rock. And on the outside, by the way, the line would probably be about where the habitable zone is, the green zone. Then on the left side, it's colder. So you get gas giants and ice giants, like Jupiter and Saturn are gas giants. Uranus and Neptune are ice giants. They have some gas, but they're so cold, a lot of ice. So that's just another way to conceive how planets are formed. More conclusions. Inward migration of gas giants scatters and disrupts protoplanets, often ejecting planets, leaving highly inclined or retrograde orbits. Retrograde means backwards. estimated to be billions of rogue planets with no star. So have you ever seen a sci-fi where some planet, you're going, oh, that's stupid. Well, it's not. You know, some planet's coming into our solar system. It could happen. We can't see them. They're out there past our solar system. There's lots of them. Jupiter-Saturn interactions depleted our asteroid belt. That was helpful for us. And it doesn't happen on if the gas giant only moves in, the asteroid belts stay out there, and they're going to keep pelting the planets inside. Whereas ours moved out, our gas giants, and it caused that asteroid belt to a lot of those, you know, collided with Saturn and Jupiter, and a lot of them went into the sun. And so our solar system is much more stable. Yeah, Dave.
Speaking of asteroid belts, I think the reason that our solar system is so unique and just doesn't get talked about a lot, only a few papers on it, is our solar system very unique in that we have five asteroid belts.
Yeah.
Besides discovering exoplanets, the other thing that we've been able to study is the plastismos, the
planetesimals,
of other stars, and most of them have no asteroid belt at all.
Yeah.
They have just one giant, huge one, which is why the eccentricity of all these exoplanets is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are tidally locked,
exactly,
circular, but the ones that are not tidally locked always have huge eccentricity. They look like Pluto.
Yeah.
And of course, that means that they get really hot, they get really cold.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's see. Our solar system is considered to be an outlier. That's the word. Among known systems. Two gas giants in distant orbits are very unusual. Rocky planets with periods greater than 100 days are very unusual. And we'll see that in a moment. These graphs are just a way to show you how fast we've discovered exoplanets. I'm not going to spend much time on those. But you can see in the year 2010 how it started increasing. And then, whew, now we're discovering them like crazy. And they're going to put up more satellites. We're over 1,000, a little over 1,000 confirmed exoplanets and another 5,000 candidates.
Wow.
So they got to get some more info before they can say they're confirmed. Here's another graph. It just shows you that most of them, see where E and J are circled up at the top? That's Earth and Jupiter. Most of them are Jupiter-sized so far. And that could be because our equipment just isn't good enough to see the little ones. Like some people call it a selection bias. Another way to look at it, the methods we talked about for finding exoplanets, radio velocity and transit are the two main, the first two you see on there, all the reds and the greens. And you can compare it to where Earth is. Earth is just a little tiny thing because what they're doing is comparing the mass of Jupiter. And Earth, we have about 1% of the mass of Jupiter. And you see the other planets there, but most of the planets we found so far are really big. Very few are small. These are logarithmic scales on this because, you know, they're finding so many, they have to put things in logarithmic scale.
Would you say that most of these planets were discovered with methods other than the Keck and the Hubble telescopes? They were discovered through radio?
No, most were discovered with the Kepler satellite by the transit method.
Kepler satellite.
Yeah. okay, we'll end with this. I'll show you this, if I can find it on here. and it's a. Let me tell you what it's going to be first. This is just an artist representation. I've got a video of it, so it's going to be movement. And here you see it says solar system in the middle. See those little dotted lines going around right here? Those are that's our sun in the middle, and then Mercury, Earth, Venus, Earth, Mars. Then you get out here, Jupiter, Saturn, and then on out here, of course, or Uranus. So keep your eye on those little dotted orbits, the dotted lines going around. All these other things you see on here are the stars we found with their planets. And you see they got little tiny orbits around them? So the artist just took them, threw them all within our solar system so you could compare the size of orbits of all the other things we found to our solar system. Now, there are a few exceptions, like Kepler-452b. But most of them have little tiny orbits. So let me see if I can get it running here. And this one will have sound, Dave. Everything moved on here. Spinning worlds, that's it. Ready? We can run it twice. It's only a minute long or so. So remember where our orbit is. Now look at all these other little orbits. Got like Brownian movement. Yeah, an artist actually did this. Like this. That's its entire orbit. Entire system. Yeah, that's the big picture, showing our entire solar system. I think it goes back out again. There you can see our planets real well on here. And if you were really good, I'll let you watch it again. It's gone over again. They do. So they're adding some into it as we go.
Wow.
It's only a minute long. So. Well, isn't that neat? I love it. Who said scientists can't be artists? It's almost done. So does that make sense, what they're showing there? Okay. 1 second, I'll take questions, final question. Okay.
What does the color mean? Earth was on the bottom? What's the
time? The color you had, most of them you noticed were red with a white planet going around it or something. But that's because most are M-class red dwarf stars. And 80% of the stars in the heaven are that. Okay, Jocelyn.
Are you saying that ours is the only one at that size? All the rest of them are tiny?
I said that there are exceptions that are as big as ours. Like that Kepler-452b, it had a yellow star. But it didn't, as far as I can tell, Kepler-452 does not have gas giants outside of 452b. So it's still much smaller than...
And so they're all small?
They're all small.
And ours is the only big?
Ours is the only big one. Does that sound like some kind of master design, you know?
Are there two stars in the Milky Way only, or...?
Only ones... The Milky Way is our galaxy, right?
Yeah.
That we live in.
Right.
And that's all we can really tell. We cannot look at any... unless they're really big, big stars, we can't see stars outside of our galaxy. We can see other galaxies.
And that's irrelevant, too. So I think people
it
say,
is.
Well, okay, we haven't found any Earth-like planets or stars, and we can find one in others. The problem is all the other galaxies,
yeah.
None of those are inhabitable because we've not found a stable spiral galaxy.
Right.
So our Milky Way is also
yeah.
unique, just as our star is unique, our planet's unique, our Milky Way galaxy
yeah.
is unique.
That's another talk,
you
even.
You can't move the problem someplace else.
No. And that's what they're going to do. That's what.
But they can.
They will try.
They try.
Once they, if you add these nine zones that I talked about, we shouldn't be here. You know, we cannot. How do you get all these to overlap at the same way? So what they're going to do, they're going to, you know, in 50 years, 100 years, they're going to find out we can't find another solar system in our galaxy, in the Milky Way galaxy. So it must be in another galaxy. That's the answer. So you're appealing to the unknown. Yeah, Mara.
And all of this is going around us and us going like this. It's like we're so heavy.
What's so strange is that all these stars and galaxies relate back to us.
Yes.
They really do.
I know, and then he made this all for us.
Yeah.
But we worry about the most stupid stuff.
We do.
Well,
that's Mark's category, so he really knows about that stuff.
Yeah,
we're out of time. I'll say a prayer.
Well,
unfortunately, I only got about halfway done, okay? So someday, you know, if there's time, we'll get into it and finish it. But I think, for me, as I said earlier, I love NASA. I really do, you know. I love what they do. But there's a lot of hype. So you as a Christian, and I had slides for you, to tell you how to deal with this stuff. And we ran out of time. And next time we'll do that. Don't disregard it. It's very important. Learn what you can, because a lot of people, skeptics, scientist skeptics, and normal, regular people skeptics, accept this stuff, and they believe that there's intelligent aliens all over the place. And they base it a lot on what they hear in the news. So I'll save it for another time, and we'll get into what Christians do and how you really relate to it. Okay, so let's just say a prayer and we'll leave. Lord God, thank you for your universe, Lord, for making it part of our existence. Help us to understand it, Lord, and especially help people that are skeptical and of your word, of your salvation, and that are buying into a lot of this propaganda, Lord, that tells them that we aren't important, that there are other things in the universe far more important than us and you. And we ask you now, Lord, to be with us throughout the week. Bless Hugh Ross, wherever he's at, and keep him energized and working hard through the years. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. Thank you.